Greetings. Welcome to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge, Director of the Economic and Political Justice Program. As always, we hope this resource informs you about issues you feel are important, but not hearing elsewhere, updates you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspires you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that create real change. Today is Friday, February 6th, and on this date in 1756, a guy by the name of Aaron Burr was born. Burr was Vice President of the United States under Jefferson, but was also a business person, and it was in that capacity that he and others convinced New York City Council to charter a company called the Manhattan Corporation back in 1799. The purpose of that company ostensibly was to raise dams and divert water throughout the city in response to the outbreak of yellow fever and other health issues. A provision of that charter, however, allowed the company to divert its excess capital in any capacity, quote, non-inconsistent with the Constitution laws of the United States, unquote. Well, this vague clause enabled the company to engage in, of all things, banking activities. And what happened was eventually this company became one of the most powerful banks, not only in New York City or in New York State, but around the United States, because the Manhattan Corporation was the predecessor of what is now the J.P. Morgan Chase Corporation. You see, back way back when, in 1799, corporations could only be chartered one at a time, meaning they could only get their life, if you will, their ability to do business by being anointed, by receiving a charter by a public entity. They had no inalienable constitutional rights, only privileges bestowed upon them by elected representatives. And that's what the Manhattan Corporation was then. It only got its right to do what the city council thought they were only going to do, but because of this weird little loophole, allowed them to venture out in what becomes the most important financial or most important corporate function of them all, and that is being involved in banking and finance, because that's where the real money was to be made and is still to be made, not just in 1799, but in 2015. So it is the corporate charter that permitted individuals, we the people, and those we elect, to control, to regulate, to define corporations then, and to a certain extent, to a great extent, still remains the case today, but we haven't used that democratic tool. And to some extent, corporations have been shielded, having corporate charters taken away from them by the Constitution, by declaring they have inalienable constitutional rights. Well, so much for that little bit of history lesson, but it was on this date that that occurrence did take place, that of Aaron Burr, his birth, and his nefarious activity later in life. This week's podcast features, as always, reports on last week's activities, upcoming events and activities next week, and reflections on various current AFSC-related news items. This past week, on Tuesday, we were involved in supporting the burgeoning Talmadge Move to Amend group. They're getting off the ground. Plans are underway for their, they would like to have a citizen initiative either put on the ballot by council or via petition, which they are prepared to do if council here this month does not do the heavy lifting at the front end by choosing to put the measure on the ballot for voter consideration in November. So anyone who may be listening who is living in Talmadge or anywhere near, they now have a new Facebook page. Go to Move to Amend Talmadge. You can find it, like it, and become involved. There's information about their next meeting coming up in a few weeks. Wednesday evening was scheduled to be the initial gathering of people in Lyndhurst to plan for a Move to Amend effort in that community, but Mother Nature had other plans, so that meeting was postponed until early in March, which we will make mention of later. Thursday, two events that took place, one of which was more a meeting among representatives of a couple different organizations, including myself, representing AFSC, at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairlawn. There is a joint, I think it'll be four organizations, planning what is being called a Theater of the Oppressed training. This is a type of empowerment training that uses theater-based activities to examine and overcome oppression. Theater of the Oppressed is used around the world. It was begun in South America by a man named Augusto Boal, and it's a device used to examine structural oppression, collectively propose solutions, and activate bottom-up change. Sort of the mantra is don't spectate, but participate, and audiences do that by not just watching these plays on social issues get played out in front of them, but become actively involved and suggest alternative actions, ideas, or endings to plays that are put on in front of them concerning concrete and salient and current events. And this leads to concrete actions and have done so around the world, not just at a grassroots level, but also up at a legislative level as well. And has resulted in changing the world through immediate applications of those actions in communities, in schools, in organizations, and in governments. So this event, it's a two-day event, March 26th and 27th, though individuals can choose to only participate in the first day. That would be Thursday, March 26th. Yeah, both days are from 9 to 5. It's going to be at the UU Church in Akron, located in Fairlawn. More information, there is a Facebook page on it, or you can get more information, the flyer itself. You can download about it on our website, afsc.org/Akron. To register, if what I've just said is enough to convince you to RSVP. It is free, but we do acquire RSVPs for food for lunch and other snacks throughout the day. You can do so by emailing AFSC Workshops. That's all one word, AFSC Workshops at gmail.com. There'll be more mentioned about this in the next few weeks. So that was Wednesday morning with representatives of the sponsoring organizations. And it should be said, there is the main group doing this. I mean, we're sponsoring at AFSC, but there's a professor who teaches at Kent State University who is head of a national organization called Pedagogy and Theater of the Oppressed that is going to be the main resource person who will be facilitating and enabling and encouraging and inspiring both days. So well worth the examination. Again, for more info, check out either our Facebook, it is on our Facebook page as well, I believe, but also go to Theater of the Oppressed Facebook page as well as our website. Thursday evening, yesterday was in the evening, the meeting, latest meeting of the Cleveland Move to Amend affiliate at the Slavic Village Development Office on Broadway at 7 o'clock. Spent quite a bit of time going over a draft petition. This would be an actual a citizen initiative that would be passed around within the city of Cleveland to garner what is needed, and that is 5,000 valid signatures to get this measure on the ballot. The goal is to have a citizen initiative on the ballot in November 2016. Calling on Congress to pass a constitutional amendment to declare corporations are not people, money's not speech, and as decided last night, to hold a biennial, that would be every other year, public hearing sponsored by the city that would take place in May that would permit citizens to show up and testify up to 5 minutes in length on the impact of corporate influence and big money on the affairs of the city and of the people and of their communities. So that language is being firmed up. It's still going to be vetted, if you will, to many people in Cleveland. We will be sending that out, and the Cleveland Move to Amend group will be sending that out to their supporters in Cleveland for feedback and for input for their next meeting coming up in a few weeks. Details later on that. So those were the activities that took place this last week that we had some role in one way or another. Turning now to events, activities coming up next week. The main activity will be next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I will be at Miami University down in Oxford, involved in a number of programs and talks. A campus-wide talk Monday evening at 7:30 p.m. at the Shriver Center on the campus of Miami University on the topic of our government is broken because the system is fixed, creating a real democracy movement. That is sponsored by a number of organizations on campus, and that begins at 7:30. That's Monday, February 9th. On the 10th, I'll be speaking to various college classes, I don't know, three or four of them. And then in the evening, there is a meeting that will be co-sponsored by the Move to Amend affiliate organization in Oxford. The Oxford Citizens for Peace and Justice is involved, as is the Butler County Democrats and maybe one or two others, for an evening program on Move to Amend, corporate power, money is speech, and related activities and issues, and hopefully inspired actions to be taken in Oxford and adjoining communities. Wednesday, the 11th, then in the morning, I speak to one or two classes and then head back to Northeast Ohio. So that's February 9th, 10th, and 11th, Miami University. On the 12th, there will be a public meeting of Radio Free Akron at 6 p.m. at the Highland Square Library, 807 West Market Street. It will be an information meeting on how to become involved in launching a grassroots low-power radio station in Akron. We're certainly looking for even more people to become involved and engaged and active in any one or ones of three active committees we have going. Why and the importance of the low-power FM radio station in Akron can be made and was made very effectively last week in an interview with Jennifer Tolles that took place on this podcast, which is archived. You can hear it if you missed it and would like to hear firsthand from the president of the board of Radio Free Akron, Jennifer Tolles, who also is an organizer of the Akron and Ohio Organizing Collaborative. You can go hear that on our website or check out, I think it's also on our Facebook page, a link to that interview, about 10 minutes long or so. So that is on Thursday, February 12th, 6 p.m., Highland Square Library in Highland Square, 807 West Market Street. Open to anyone, whether you live in Akron or not, anyone who would like to see low-power, grassroots, bottom-up, democratic radio be launched in the city of Akron, join us. While we're not involved in these next two activities, we certainly were involved to some extent in helping these activities come to pass, namely the efforts in the city of Mentor and Defiance, not in a major way, but nevertheless in some way, in promoting and helping those communities get on the ballot and passed in their communities a Move to Amend initiative. And in the case of Mentor, that initiative passed in 2014 by 70%, and in Defiance in 2013 with 67%. In support. Well, both of their initiatives called for in both communities, as is the case in Brecksville, Cleveland Heights, Newburgh Heights, and where else am I missing? One other community that passed this, and I'm drawing a blank at the moment, but Cleveland Heights, Newburgh Heights, Brecksville, and wow, I can't believe, I can't remember at the moment the other community. Anyway. Oh, Chagrin Falls, of course, Chagrin Falls. In all of those four communities, excuse me, there will be, if not has already occurred this year, what's called a democratic or democracy public hearing, or in some communities actually called a democracy a day public hearing that calls for, as what I just mentioned in Cleveland, a annual or biennial public hearing where citizens can show up and testify on the impact of corporate money and big money and the influence in general of corporations in corrupting, usurping, hijacking public policy and democratic self-governance. So is the case in Mentor and Defiance, where this week on Wednesday, February 11th at 7 p.m., will be the Mentor Democracy Day public hearing at Mentor City Hall Council Chambers, 8500 Civic Center Boulevard in Mentor. On Thursday, February 12th, 6:30 p.m., in the Defiance City Hall, Defiance will hold their Democracy Day public hearing. And Defiance City Hall is located at 631 Perry Street in Defiance. So those are the activities coming up that we are involved in that you should certainly participate in every case and ability that you are able, whether in Akron in the public hearing, or I should say the public meeting of Radio Free Akron or Mentor. Defiance may be a ways, Miami may be a ways, of course, depending on where you are. So those are the activities for next week. We turn next to comments on various news items, issues, or social actions that we have some interest in or connection to, either currently in the recent past or maybe something coming up in the near future. Well, this past week, I guess you could say, was the week in one sense of budgets. Budgets were released by the president and by the governor of Ohio, giving their views and their assessments of where they think our tax dollars, mine and yours, should be spent in a variety of different ways. Early this week, I think it was on Monday, the president released his fiscal year budget for the current fiscal year. And his proposed discretionary spending. Now, this is the amount of money. You often hear different terms thrown around when you hear about the budget and how much is being spent and, you know, what is being spent on. And oftentimes the numbers seem dramatically different. And it's not because those figures, particularly when measured in a pie chart formation, is inaccurate, where one person is lying by saying the military budget is, you know, 30% and somebody else says it's 50%. Both can be right. It depends on what is being thrown into that pie crust, if you will, and how large or small that pie in fact may be. But when it comes to the amount of money that Congress and the president can actually decide what is to be spent on, that's called discretionary spending. Social Security and a few other funds are in a supposedly locked box, and those are funds raised and spent independent from what Congress technically can decide is going to be spent on. The amount of funds, the pool of funds, or the pie, if you will, that Congress can decide and the president can decide will be spent on. Actually, it's Congress's final decision because they control the purse strings. So Congress has the final rule. The president can only veto or sign. That is called discretionary spending. So the president, in his proposed budget for this year, in terms of discretionary spending, he wants 55 cents out of every dollar that Congress is to vote on to go to the military-industrial complex, 55 cents, only 6 cents on education, the same for veterans benefits, the same for government, a nickel for housing and community, Medicare and health, and unemployment and labor would be 5% or 5 cents, 3 cents of every dollar of the president's proposed discretionary spending he calls to be spent on energy and the environment and international affairs and science, 2 cents on transportation, and a measly penny on food and agriculture. So more than half of every dollar the president would like to be spent, that he has the power to have some say-so, at least in promoting a budget that Congress will vote on, will, he proposes, should be spent on the military-industrial complex. Well, this is politically, economically, militarily, and morally, I believe, a bankrupt budget proposal. Politically, it represents a massive disconnect between what most people want and what's being proposed. Most people don't want more than half of all dollars that goes in our name, coming from our pockets, being spent going to the military. Yet that is what is being proposed in Congress. Obviously is not going to slash this by 20 or 30%. They may up it or decline it a couple percentage points, but it's going to be roughly that amount. Economically, it is awful because measured in economic terms, military expenditures are among, if not the worst means of creating jobs per dollar spent. You can create many more jobs in things like education and rebuilding infrastructure and housing and communities assistance and all those kinds of things because they are not as technologically intensive. Why military production is such a poor jobs creator is that it is extremely high tech. And as such, it does not take very many people to produce the planes and tanks and missiles and bombs and bullets and other forms of high-tech hardware. So just from an economic standpoint, if you're trying to create jobs, if you're trying to prime the pump economically, spending money on the military is just about the absolute worst way you can do it. Militarily, well, besides the waste, fraud, and abuse, there's not been a decent audit of the military for years. What is it going for? Well, it's upholding the hundreds of military bases and installations worldwide. It is, if you will, resembling a Dunkin' Donut in a sense, in that it fortifies the edges of our empire by having all of these bases, all of these installations, all of these weapons forward deployed in Europe, in Asia, in other regions of the world, while the center becomes empty, just like a donut. And that's what's happening in this country. It's decaying from within. We are not spending the resources, the human, the social, the infrastructure. We're not investing in 21st century non-military technologies in research and development on energy, on transportation, on manufacturing, on infrastructure. Other countries are doing it. It's no wonder that the solar and wind and other forms of technology and high-speed rail cars are not produced in the United States but abroad because we're putting our best brain power as well as our money and research and development in producing weapons of mass destruction. And it's morally bankrupt. You know, budgets more than anything else is the greatest measurement, maybe the single greatest measurement of our nation's morals, values, and priorities. Never mind what constitutions say, never mind what edicts say, what State of the Union addresses say, what congressional calls by speakers of the houses or presidents of the Senates may say. The bottom line is the bottom line. Where we spend our money is the best metric of our values and our priorities. And to see so much money going into the military sends the kind of message that we, in fact, care far less about building and creating than we do about destroying and blowing up. Those are our values. Those are our priorities. Those are our morals. And they are just sickening. It's at least that's what our leaders, the morals and the values and the principles of them. It's not the morals and values and principles of many people in this country, of arguably the vast majority of people in this country. And it's only going to change when we step up, stand up, and become engaged to take back, or maybe to take for the very first time, authentic control of our nation. Well, that's the federal budget, the Kasich budget for Ohio. The Ohio Governor John Kasich introduced his own budget for the next 2 years, released this week. An analysis from One Ohio Now says, quote, "It's a massive tax shift with little else, though it does contain some good elements." And Policy Matter Ohio talks about it does retain the eligibility for 450,000 Ohioans who signed up for health care through the Affordable CARE Act, expansion of Medicaid last year, and it also increases tobacco taxes. So those are good. But there are precious few serious investments that attempt to solve major problems like rising poverty and unconstitutional school funding system, crumbling roads and bridges, and more. The only real strategy, according to One Ohio Now, in their analysis, is to shift taxes. And that's not been an effective remedy since 2005, and the research tells us that we shouldn't expect to see it work now. Since 2005, in Ohio, there has been repeated promises, the same sort of repeated promise that if we cut taxes, there will be, the age-old thing of trickle down, right? Instead of percolate up, if we just cut taxes to the well-to-do and to top businesses, they will employ more. They'll hire more. Well, the simple economics 101 says, companies are only going to produce something if there is a demand. And if nobody demands a widget, a company is not going to produce a widget. And so if there's growing poverty and less income growth, people are not going to hire. So to cut taxes to people at the top is only benefiting people at the top. It's not expanding the ability of people at the bottom to purchase, to consume, and to create and generate economic activity from the bottom up. It just hasn't worked. Yet the proposed budget of the administration of John Kasich includes another 23% income tax cut based on the belief that wealth will trickle down while raising sales taxes. Sales taxes are the most, I think it is considered to be the most regressive tax of them all. Regressive meaning it hits people at the bottom disproportionately more than people at the top. While wealth, in particular, a wealth tax is maybe the most progressive, meaning it hits people at the top the hardest versus people at the bottom, since the wealthiest people pay the most tax. Well, the Kasich budget talks about shifting taxes away from income taxes and more toward sales taxes. So that's shifting from a progressive to a regressive tax system. This plan will make our tax code less fair and bring in less revenue that we should be investing in our education, our infrastructure, and improving quality of life. So that's the proposed Kasich budget for the next 2 years that the Ohio Senate and House will be deliberating on between now and when the budget must be approved in some form by, I believe it's July 1. Well, there's an underlying assumption about budgets, be they federal, state, or local, and economies, that's the topic of this next story. And that's the economic growth, about economic growth and how economic growth is inherently good, always good, no matter how that economic growth is generated. The British Guardian newspaper this week published a fascinating article about GDP, which stands for Gross Domestic Product, which for people who need a refresher in that is the overall measurement, GDP, of how our economy is doing. If you will, the sum of all goods and services produced in the economy, in our economy, whether it's services or construction, energy, agriculture, manufacturing, government, whatever the case may be. Government policies and capitalist markets watch GDP very closely. When GDP goes up, you see markets go up and governments feeling better about things and saying, well, maybe we can spend more tax dollars on something because, look, the economy is growing. But is it a good indicator to measure healthy progress? Increasingly, there are people asking that question and asking that maybe we need to take a step back and rethink and reshift and maybe come up with a different measurement of economic progress and overall healthy progress in a healthy society. Because you see, one problem is that everything that happens in an economy adds to the GDP, be it producing a solar panel or cleaning up an oil spill. But, how do you say that cleaning up an oil spill has equal societal benefit than producing a solar panel? Well, it doesn't. Money spent in our healthcare system on treating cancer is greater under a GDP system than money spent in our healthcare system preventing it. So if more money is spent treating an existing cancer than being spent on trying to prevent cancer in the first place, well, the GDP goes up and the overall economy grows more when people are being treated for rather than prevented from getting cancer. A second problem with GDP is that it doesn't account for what's called natural capital, depletion or pollution of forests, rivers, airs, or oceans. And because of that, it's a flawed and very blunt economic measuring tool. A third problem with GDP is that it doesn't account for the distribution of growth. Uneven growth isn't really accounted for. Growth has been used by the power elite for a very long time in this country and elsewhere to avoid questions of equity. So long as the overall pie grows and everyone is getting slightly more, people won't look at or question why certain slices of the pie are much larger than others. In fact, Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz wrote in the Guardian newspaper last autumn, quote, "Regardless of how fast GDP grows, an economic system that fails to deliver gains for most of its citizens and in which a rising share of the population faces increasing insecurity is, in a fundamental sense, a failed economic system," unquote. That from Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz. Well, finally, GDP doesn't reflect things that have no market price but are good for our society, like volunteer work, parenting in the home, public investments in education and research. Well, it's becoming apparent that GDP is not a very good measurement. And in wealthy industrialized countries, such as recently in France and England, they are beginning to look at alternatives and alternative measurements, alternative tools, metrics for assessing national well-being. But even in this country, there's an increasing feeling that after a certain point, continuing economic growth doesn't do much to improve people's satisfaction. A whole field of happiness economics has emerged to try to identify other factors besides GDP that can predict individual well-being. In France and England, both nations at the national level, the highest national level, at the executive level, presidential level, MP level, have commissioned studies looking into alternative measures of national well-being. And this is much needed, for if your yardstick is flawed, you'll never obtain an accurate measurement. And it's time that we in this country, as is beginning to happen elsewhere in Europe and in other places, that we develop a more humane and sustainable combined economic, social, and environmental yardstick. So next time you hear our politicians or economic professors or anyone else equate automatically with rising GDP must be great for the economy because it measures economic growth, that needs to be deconstructed, and that needs to be challenged, that needs to be asked, and that needs to be called for an alternative to something other than this very flawed, blunt measuring tool and measuring stick, yardstick, that is incredibly imperfect and does not, in the larger sense, increase our overall well-being. Well, speaking of connecting what we oftentimes keep separated in terms of academic disciplines, in the former case, it was talking about needing to combine economic, social, and environmental factors when determining and coming up with an alternative to the GDP yardstick. Here, it's time to combine economic and political disciplines. And in doing so, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders this week said that this is what oligarchy looks like. He said, quote, "Today, the top 0.1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. The top 0.01% makes more than 40% of all campaign contributions. The billionaire class, therefore, owns the political system and reaps the benefits from it," unquote. As we have commented on before, you cannot separate economic wealth and growing economic wealth and the incredible economic gap growing between the very rich and everyone else from the growing political gap between the very rich and everyone else. They go hand in hand and have to be focused on, in some cases, hand in hand. And as long as we continue to have this massive growth of the oligarchy, of the one percenters, we are going to see those people do everything they can to translate their economic power into political power. And so long as money equals speech, they have got a perfect cover and a perfect avenue for doing just that. Well, staying with politics, Mitt Romney this week decided to exit from the presidential campaign. It unleashed a frenzy of fresh fundraising and set off a new race for the backing of donors who had remained loyal to the 2012 Republican nominee. Well, this simply shows what presidential politics is all about, doesn't it? That unless you're able to receive commitments of tens of millions of dollars before you even declare your candidacy, you're just not a serious candidate. Romney raised more than $57 million before the first voting took place in 2012. And that figure now is cited as this campaign's benchmark. Unless you're able to raise at least that amount of money, you're not going to be considered a viable candidate. Well, it's not voters, is it, who's determining who's viable? It's funders. More confirmation, is it not, to what Bernie Sanders has said. Lastly, for this week, a comment on a article concerning, again, misnamed, horribly misnamed so-called trade agreements. An article this week appearing on, of all places, something called Tech Dirt. That's T-E-C-H-D-I-R-T, techdirt.com. It was titled, Two Leaks Reveal How TTIP's Regulatory Cooperation Body Will Undermine Sovereignty and Democracy. And what it addresses is the U.S.-European trade deal called the TTIP. You know, there's this Asian equivalent called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But there's also this U.S. and European trade deal called the TTIP that is really not about trade at all. Trade barriers between the U.S. and Europe are already virtually nil. I think just a very small percentage of the total amount in question. This deal, certainly like the TPP, the Asian-U.S. equivalent, has largely not much to do with removing trade barriers, but about removing non-trade barriers, those things that we call democratically enacted laws and regulations governing things like worker rights, environmental protections, consumer protections, those that we call important to protect the health, safety, and welfare, but that the corporate crowd calls barriers and that need to be removed and will do anything they feel is required to remove them. Well, following a public outcry in both the U.S. and especially Europe, negotiators now have said that non-trade barriers will now not be lowered, and thus the agreement should be approved by Congress and by the European Union. However, there were two separate leaks this week that took place that showed from people on the inside who were involved in these negotiations between the U.S. and Europe that shows how corporations could still gut democratically enacted laws even if the TTIP is passed without reducing the so-called non-trade barriers. The first leak talked about a new transatlantic organization to be created by the European Union called the Regulatory Cooperation Body. And this body would allow corporate lobbyists to shape the regulations as they are created by the European Union when implementing the agreement. So the agreement may be, you know, on the surface as is, pretty strong, relatively speaking, but in the course of the implementation, which would be done under the provisions of the TTIP agreement by the European Union, the corporations would be in the front row, having basically first crack at shaping the regulations required to implement this agreement. Any new regulations would also have to produce a quote-unquote impact assessment, focusing on the impact of whatever this trade or investment you know, whatever this regulation would be on trade and investment considerations, not how this regulation might impact workers, consumers, or the environment, but in fact how this regulation implemented under the TTIP would impact trade and investment. That's the only lens that would be looked through. So anything that might hurt trade and or financial investment would be something that the corporate lobbyist crowd could impact by suggesting that it be scrapped. Well, a second leak called for establishing a U.S.-European Union financial regulatory forum that would, quote-unquote, harmonize, meaning gut, provisions between both countries. What it would do is it would reduce to the lowest standard financial rules and oversights, which would benefit, guess who or what, major financial corporations. What these two leaks this week confirm is that the regulatory cooperation that lies at the heart of the TTIP would undermine sovereignty or democracy on both sides of the Atlantic. Therefore, they must be stopped. Contact your senators, that would be Senator Portman and Brown, and your congressional representative. Urge them to vote no on the TTIP, and while you're at it, the TPP, and while you're at it, on Fast Track. That would allow much easier by the administration to push through and ram through both the TTIP and the TPP. That's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our website is afsc.org/Akron. Facebook page, go to Facebook and put in NEOAFSC. Our program blog, northeastohioafsc.wordpress.com. My blog, createrealdemocracy.wordpress.com. Till next week, onward for justice, peace, and democracy.